Just the mention of Tiananmen Square conjures up memories of student demonstrators, a Chinese version of our Statue of Liberty, and that young man who stepped in front of an approaching army tank, bringing the long line of military personnel to a halt. The uprising failed and untold numbers of Chinese lost their lives, but until recently we knew very little about what went on behind the scenes among Chinese leaders. That is the subject of Terry Clark's conversation with Andrew Nathan.
In spring of 1989, Beijing students began a prolonged demonstration on Tiananmen Square to push for deeper economic reforms and continued liberalization. As the demonstrations dragged on, the students in the regime became increasingly less able to engage in dialogue. This despite the fact that the students had eschewed any direct challenge to the continuation of Communist Party rule. The incident was ultimately brought to a violent end when elements of the People's Liberation Army forcibly cleared the square. Documents chronicling the Communist Party's decision during this period have recently been published in a book titled The Tiananmen Papers, The Chinese Leadership's Decision to Use Force Against Their Own People, in their own words. Here today to discuss the book is co-editor Andrew J. Nathan, professor of political science at Columbia University. Welcome to our show, Professor Nathan.
Thank you.
Professor Nathan, perhaps we should start with the history behind these demonstrations to remind our listeners. But how was it that the students came to decide upon and begin these demonstrations on Tiananmen Square?
Well, there was a lot of pressure building up in China in 1988 and the early part of 89, partly because of inflation and growing corruption problems and a feeling on the part of citizens that the party had kind of lost track of how to continue to push the reforms forward and all those things. But it kind of came to a head when one of the party leaders died, a man named Hu Yaobang, whom the students worshipped and looked up to as an exemplar of reform and as a liberal. So with his death, the students came out to demonstrate in memorial, in mourning for him, and presented a petition to the central party leadership that we should move ahead in the spirit of Hu Yaobang to push reform. And then it was the ham-handed reaction of the leadership not accepting the petition, not knowing what to do with the student demonstrators, and not really sympathizing enough with what the student demonstrators stood for, that angered the students and made the demonstrations get bigger and bigger. Beijing is a university town. There are a lot of universities there. And after the first handfuls participated, more and more of the students from the Beijing campuses came out. And then, jumping ahead a few weeks, they finally got to where they were camping out in Tiananmen Square in the heart of Beijing and declared a hunger strike. So at that point, they very much sharpened their challenge to the government. And it was after that that other citizens from other walks of life also began to pour into the streets, to go marching through Tiananmen Square with their own banners, organized in groups to demonstrate their support for the students. So then it got even bigger. And it also spread to the whole country. It spread to over 400 cities around the country, again, with a similar mix of students at the center and citizens marching to support them.
The citizens, the non-student participants, were they from the working classes, from the professional classes?
They were chiefly from the professional classes. Beijing, besides being a college town, is the national capital, so it's like Washington, D.C., most of the people who live there seem to be government bureaucrats. And one of the most scary things for the party leaders was to see their own bureaucrats from different government agencies, from the People's Daily, from the Central People's Television, broadcasting station and so forth, also coming out to support the students. So in Beijing, it was mostly middle-class people. The working class factory workers came out to a certain extent, but the students actually were quite careful, most of the students, not to try to get the workers to too much involved, because as you said in your intro, the students didn't want to challenge party rule directly, either because they to some extent still supported the party or because they knew it might be too dangerous to do so. But in any case, going to the workers, they knew would be a very neuralgic thing for the party leaders, that would signal some kind of revolution. And another class that wasn't involved was the peasantry, mainly because they were out in the countryside. And this was an urban movement.
It was an urban movement, but did it in any way involve the provincial capitals?
Oh, yeah. It involved all the biggest, as I said, over 400 cities around the country, which includes every provincial capital and many, many other small, large and medium-sized cities. So it covered urban China, but it didn't get out into the rural areas because I think it's hard for, I mean, the rural people didn't feel part of this issue, for one thing, and also it's hard for them to find a place to demonstrate, a government office to go demonstrate against.
That's interesting that the peasants then were largely left out. Does this in any way count for the willingness of the People's Liberation Army to engage in forcibly extracting the students from the square?
It's an interesting theory, because the People's Liberation Army mostly is made up of sons of the peasantry, but I think probably the most important thing there is just that it's a military body, a well-disciplined one. The orders came down from the top. And there wasn't a single officer except one. There was only one serving officer that we know of from these documents who refused orders, a general named Xu Qinxian, who commanded one of the armies. And he told his superiors, I won't move my troops into Beijing. So they got rid of him. The whole rest of this vast military machine obeyed orders, perfectly. So I guess they were sufficiently disciplined and in their chain of command so that they did what they were told to do.
Your book is a compendium of new sources of information now on all of these events. What are the sources of the information itself, and what are the materials that have been collected?
The basis of the book is Chinese government documents, internal government documents of various types. For example, reports to the party center from ministries like the Ministry of State Security, the Ministry of Railways, and so forth, reports from the provinces, from the provincial party committees, and then also minutes of meetings of the Politburo and the Politburo Standing Committee, and a limited number of other kinds of documents from which we can reconstruct private conversations. For example, memoranda of conversations that, in particular, one person, Yang Shangkun, compiled. So it's a bunch of documents like that. Now, what I worked with as an editor, though, was a manuscript. I have to tell you a little bit how this came to be. I was approached by the person that we call the compiler, a Chinese person, who said, I have lots and lots and lots of documents that I want to publish. And I told him, you'd better select the best ones and arrange them in chronological order and put some shape to this thing. Give that to me so I can work with it. So he gave me a 516-page computer printout of the transcriptions of the material that he had selected, and that's what I worked with. So I don't want your listeners to misunderstand that I was physically pawing through a big pile of documents. I wasn't doing that. But the base from which he transcribed all this stuff is government documents.
Yeah, obviously, 516 pages, that's still a lot to cull through. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that what you try to do is find the more interesting insights that they provide us. What would be, in your view, those particulars that we otherwise would not know? Or what kind of a view do they give us that we wouldn't otherwise have?
Yeah, let me answer this in two stages. First, by saying that, as you pointed to, the selection process, which first part of it was his selection from the entire body of material that he had to the 516 pages, and then from there my selection to the English language book. And by the way, his 516-page Chinese language manuscript is about to be published in Chinese in April, mid-April, and it now prints up to a 1,000-page, two-volume Chinese book that will be distributed. So if any of your listeners speak Chinese, they can get a hold of that book. So your first part of my answer to your question is the selection process. What did we select for? And the answer is that we tried to select the material that would illuminate the decision-making process in the leadership compound, Zhongnanhai, and we overlooked material that describes, for example, the students in the square, which is something that specialists already know quite a bit about, or which describes the Western press response and so forth, which is something that I think Westerners already know quite a bit about. We tried to look into the decision-making process. Now, to answer the other aspect of your question is, what did we learn that was new? There are quite a few things that are new here. Some are concrete things on the order of which military units moved into Beijing, for example. But then there are some things about the Chinese system. I already mentioned one thing, that the military was obedient, which we heard rumors at the time there was much more dissent in the military. That turns out not to be true, although some retired officers did dissent, but they couldn't interfere with the process. We learned what kind of information the central leaders got, how they viewed that information. So, for example, the Ministry of State Security reports to the central leadership that students are saying this or that or the other thing, and they're being interviewed by foreign TV cameras. There were in this demonstration 7 cameras, and in that demonstration there were 6 cameras. So that information goes up the line, and we find that the reporting is quite complete and accurate. That's an interesting conclusion. But then the central leaders view this with a sort of certain colored lens that made many of them believe that the West was the Americans, the CIA, the Western media, the Taiwanese, and so forth, were behind these demonstrations, that the demonstrations had at their core some hostile elements that were trying to overthrow the Communist Party, which is not really true, as I indicated in my remarks at the beginning of the program, that, you know, the students were not aiming to overthrow the party. But the leaders picked out pieces of information, and the hardline leaders essentially massaged that kind of information for the ears of the top decision maker, Deng Xiaoping, and he got pretty alarmed about it. We also learn about the factional differences within the leadership and who wanted to deal with the student demonstrations in a hardline manner, who wanted to deal in a softline manner, and the reasons why, because we already knew that there were hard and softline factions, but what we have now is their own arguments over this thing where each side expresses in a very convincing way its view of why its policy is correct. I could go on about things that we learned, but maybe I should leave it there.
Right. The discussion of factions is interesting. It suggests that somehow there was some difficulty in coming to a consensus, and ultimately it permitted them to use force. What were the primary factors that ultimately won the day for the hardliners in the debate in the inner circle there to use force and evict the demonstrators?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that to answer that question, you need to have a feel for the power structure in the ultimate high levels of the party at that time, and it may be a little bit different, certainly different today, because the actors are not entirely the same. But at that time, there was the Politburo Standing Committee, which is the highest group on the organization chart in China then consisted of five people, and they were people in their 60s and 70s, the younger generation, if you will, although, you know, at that age, who whose job it was to handle this situation. And then above them, there was an invisible conclave that's not on the organization chart called the Elders, and they were eight people. And the most important of them was one man, Deng Xiaoping, whose power came both from his prestige and also from his from a secret party resolution which endowed him with a veto power over high decisions, and thirdly from his control of the military, because he still held the job of chair of the Central Military Commission and had the right to give orders to the military. So to answer your question, what determined the victory of the hardliners? Deng Xiaoping, the man who was supposed to handle this thing, Zhao Ziyang, the party secretary, was a softliner. And Deng Xiaoping said to him, handle it any way you want. Deng, as we know, was famously a pragmatist. Do whatever it takes, just solve it. And Zhao tried dialogue and negotiation with the students and putting out signals through the media that we understand where you're coming from and we're going to do our best and so forth and so forth. But it didn't solve the problem. So the really number one factor in the situation was that Zhao, with his softline methods, after having been given several weeks by Deng Xiaoping to deal with it, couldn't deal with it. And then the number two thing that comes in is that the head of the hardline faction, Li Peng, is able to go to Deng Xiaoping with evidence that Li Peng has garnered from the security ministry reports and elsewhere, of the sort that I mentioned earlier. The foreigners are behind this. Certain students are calling for the overthrow of you and me, you Deng Xiaoping and me Li Peng. And if we start to negotiate with this people, they're going to take us for everything we're worth and we're going to lose power. And Li made a good case. And as you read his arguments, even though you and I would not, I'm sure we would not think the way he does, there's something very compelling in the way that he views the situation. It wasn't totally without any basis. And then the third element is that once Deng swings behind the hardline posture, he has the right and the power to make that decision. And he says, we're going to have martial law. And Li Peng, and he says, you guys go and vote on this, because he wants the standing committee to vote on martial law. And they meet, and they have a debate, and they actually split. It's a dramatic moment in the book where two of the five standing committee members vote in favor of martial law, two vote against it, and the fifth guy then doesn't know what to do, and he actually abstains, which is really unusual, you know, for one of the top five power holders in any country to abstain. I mean, these people are professional politicians. He just couldn't decide what to do. Didn't want to vote for it, but knew that he shouldn't vote against it. So it goes back again to the elders, who say, okay, if you can't decide, we can, and they declare martial law. So the power of the elders and their to do it, and their determination that the time had run out for soft methods, is what ultimately caused the hardliners to win.
Professor Nathan, this has been really fascinating. I wish we had another half an hour to talk about this. Could you give me a brief assessment? What's the possibility we'll see China try a liberalization, democratization in the future?
Well, the publication of the book through a leak from Beijing clearly shows that there are still strong forces who want democratization to take place. And I think right now the power struggle seems to be heating up, actually. We see various signs of that. The outcome is uncertain, but I think we can say that the push for democratization is still ongoing.
Professor Nathan, thank you very much for being our guest today.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to Andrew J. Nathan, professor of political science at Columbia University and co-editor of the book, The Tiananmen Papers, The Chinese Leadership's Decision to Use Force Against Their Own People, in their own words.
Thank you.